If an anonymous letter comes to you, if you happen to suddenly realize this is an anonymous letter, you look and no signature, tear it up, throw it away. Don't give any credence to it all. The chairperson received the anonymous letter. It would have been better not to have called a meeting. Because you see, immediately when you called it, the assumption was that the direction said that the chairperson had received the letter and one other person had received a phone call. But the assumption was that everybody in the congregation said these rumors are flying around. And that's the problem with anonymous letters. And the anonymous phone call should just be forgotten. Now, what does that do? You see, if you give credence to an anonymous letter or phone call, you reinforce that as a way of getting problems out in the open. So you don't want to do anything with it at all. Just drop it. And that forces the person, if they have a legitimate case, it forces them out in the open where you can deal with it and get the facts. But you're just shadow boxing. And I have seen so much conflict caused by an anonymous letter or an anonymous phone caller. You have no idea if that person's a crank, if they've got a personal beef, whatever it is. Or maybe they're just the kind of person that it talks about in Proverbs, the sixth chapter. It says, there are six things which the Lord hates, seven which are an abomination to him: haughty eyes, a lying tongue, and hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that make haste to run to evil, a false witness who breathes out lies, and a man who sows discord among brothers. So, you know, there are people who just like to stir up a fight. And I think it ought to be published somewhere so everybody knows it. Anonymous letters received by the office or by any member will not be recognized. It will be thrown away. And people know then that that's not a way you can deal with that. Now, petitions are something else. If you have no legitimate way for people to register complaints or to express concerns or to give criticism or to find out information, sometimes people get up petitions because there's no other way they can have access to the decision-making of the congregation. So you have to be sure that, first of all, to prevent conflict, that you have some way for people who have legitimate concerns to express them. Now, one of the things that I always suggest to congregations is that you publish the names of leaders of the congregation, especially the chairpersons of different committees, so that you say, if you have a concern about the worship service, or a complaint to register, or you would like some of your ideas to get into worship, this is the person you contact. And if you have a concern about the youth program, then you publish the name of the chairperson of the youth committee. This is the person you contact. Give people a legitimate channels for expressing concerns, and they don't have to resort. But one of the problems that exists in congregations is that we assume, make the assumption, that because we're all Christians, nobody's ever going to register any complaints and everything is going to be okay. So we say, we don't need to bother with that because we all get along. We love each other. Aren't we all Christians? So why do we have to have any way for people to register complaints or to express concerns? But you forestall a lot of this simply by recognizing that people will have some concerns and giving them legitimate channels. Now, I mentioned that this was a pastor-parish relations committee. And I think that's a very good idea. In the South Pacific District, our pastoral support committee has published a list or a procedure for organizing such a committee in a congregation and how to select the members and how they ought to be represented to the congregation and to the pastor. So they become people who can stand in the middle and are the people who deal with incipient conflicts in the congregation. Well, suppose that there was something to this story. Suppose that there was actually something that the pastor had done. And I'm thinking of one case that I was called in on. The bishop was out of town, and the bishop's assistant, Howie Wenis, had an appointment on Wednesday night. And on Monday, we learned that a congregation had called a meeting very hastily. It was announced on Sunday after church, and a meeting was called to decide the pastor's fate on Wednesday evening. Now, you know, obviously this, I doubt if it was even according to the rubrics, and you could say it was out of order. But the feeling was running so high that the leadership called a meeting for Wednesday night. I found out about it on Tuesday, that I was to go to this meeting at which they were going to discuss the pastor's situation. Now, what had happened is the pastor had recently married, and the pastor was a widower, and he had married a new wife who was not a Lutheran, had never lived in a parsonage, and he brought his bride to the parsonage, which was next door to the church. And he had two children by his previous marriage. So here was this young woman suddenly becoming a wife and a mother. She had not been married before, and being right next door to the church. And so all of their struggles to form this new family were overheard often by people coming and going in the church. And there was a day school near the church. So, you know, the word got around that they weren't getting along too well, and they'd only been married 9 months. Well, suddenly there was a blow-up, and something happened, and the pastor stalked out of the house, which is a common, really, way for often men to handle conflict, is just to leave and slam the door behind them. And he went over to a friend in the congregation. He'd been in that congregation a year and a half, so he was better acquainted. And this person was a friend of his in his widower days, and so he went over there for some consolation and comfort. And she knew where he had gone, and she followed him over there. And by this time, she was so enraged that he'd walked out on her, and that she pounded on the door and kicked at it, and she kicked the door in. Well, what happened is that the next Sunday, the pastor preached a sermon on this, and was almost too honest about the whole situation. So then people who didn't even know that this had happened, the whole congregation knew about it. Well, they were not only offended that the pastor, that they had carried on like this, but they were offended that he had let people know that Christians and pastors act this way. So they called the meeting. Now, I came in Wednesday evening, and I hadn't worked with this congregation before. I had just done some things there on Hispanic ministries, but I hadn't really worked with the congregation. And I walked into the meeting, and there were about 60 people gathered, sitting around like this. And the president of the congregation was here, the pastor was here, and I was here. And we sat up in the front. I had no idea what was happening. I hadn't had a chance to talk to anybody before. But it became apparent to me that the congregational president did not have control of the meeting. And so there were people getting up over here and reading letters. And then there was somebody else getting up over here reading a counter statement. And somebody over here got up and read a petition. And, you know, and it was just, yes, like the cartoon or the newspaper picture. And that went on for a while until I realized that one of the first rules is somebody's got to bring structure into the conflict. People have to know what's happening. So I got up. There was a blackboard behind me, and like the eunuch, the Ethiopian eunuch, you know, who said, "There's water here. What hinders me from being baptized?" I thought, "There's a blackboard here. What hinders me from taking a piece of chalk and writing?" So all I got up, I just picked up the chalk. I went to the blackboard, and as people talked, I started writing down what they were saying. And then I'd write down another statement. What do you think that did to the conflict or to the situation? It slowed it down because they started to wait for me to finish the statement before somebody else jumped up. when they saw what they were saying put down in black and white, it looked different. And they say, no, I didn't mean that. Okay, what did you mean? Yeah. All right. What we did then was get it out of the emotional level into the rational, irrational process. And pretty soon we had a long list. Then I said, okay, we put down, is there anything more that needs to be said now to clarify this? Well, nobody talks. So I said, now would you talk in little groups and decide what is the real issue here? What's the real issue? Well, you know, they had all sorts of things. The deacon had resigned. The organist had quit and all this stuff. But, of course, what it boiled down to was, could the pastor go on being the pastor after all of this? Had people lost confidence in his ministry? So then I called for coffee break. I said, don't you have coffee? I could smell it. Yes. I said, let's take a break. Now, I made the assumption that I could take over. And there sat the president and the pastor, and I didn't ask them, but I'd been called in as a third party. They'd called for help. So I just simply did what I thought had to be done. And one of the things you've got to do is slow things down and to get a little sense of order. So we called for coffee break. And during the coffee break, I said to the pastor, do you want to stay for the rest of the meeting or do you want to go out? And then I'll come over to the parsonage and tell you afterwards. Now, his wife was not there. I said, I'll come over and tell you and your wife what happened. So he said, I think I'd better go. That'll give him a little more freedom to talk about me. Very nice and very hurt young man, but also kind of impulsive. And he had acted not circumspectly, and he knew it. But, you know, well, okay. So after coffee break, I explained to the group that I had given the pastor the option of staying or leaving. Now, another rule is everybody should know what's going on. You don't have any secrets. If the leadership makes some plans to deal with a conflict, you let everybody know what those plans are going to be. And we'll talk more about that later. So I told them, I gave the pastor a choice. I will go over to the pastor's house afterwards and tell him what happens here. So we did that. Then I just simply went up to the board and put down, divided it in two, and said, the issue apparently is the pastor stays or the pastor leaves. Now, if you want to speak to one side or another, just simply raise your hand. Everybody will be given an opportunity to talk for 1 minute, and you will not get a second opportunity till everybody else has had a first opportunity. All right, another important rule is lay down ground rules so people know how the meeting is going to be conducted. Nothing is more disastrous to a congregation than to begin to be afraid of meetings that get out of control. That fear is very real in congregations, and that fear makes people act in peculiar ways. So I just simply said, you will get 1 minute, and then you won't get... Now, then they did that. They started. Well, I said, I think you ought to leave because, okay, that was a reason. Well, I think you ought to stay. But it was all put down in orderly fashion. Okay, now behind that, what was I thinking? I didn't know, and I really was so objective. I didn't know the pastor that well, or the congregation. So I could be neutral. And it's important to have somebody who's neutral. Now, it's very difficult in the average congregation to find a neutral person whom both sides will trust. Once in a while, you can find that kind of a person. Usually it's somebody who's been around for a long time, has been on different sides of many issues so that they don't get identified as always being with that group or this group. You know, and so sometimes you can find that kind of a person, but very rarely. That's why you need somebody who has no investment in the outcome. I didn't have an investment. And maybe that's why I get called on for more conflict management than even the bishop or the bishop's assistant, because an assumption is often made by the congregation that the bishop is pro-pastor. And the bishop knows that. And in a sense, he is. He's the pastor's pastor. So as a lay person, sometimes I have more neutrality associated with me. Now, what's going on in my head while all this is happening? I have certain assumptions that I work under, or I would never even go into a conflict situation. And one of my assumptions is that in that group, because there are the people of God gathered in community, that all the gifts of the Spirit are present. You know, it says in the scripture that he gives to each of us gifts according to his will. So I knew that in that group was the Spirit, according to the scriptures, of discernment, of knowledge, of wisdom, of healing, and mercy, and helps. And the Spirit is present there. So it's important to me that that representative group become the body out of which decisions come, so that I don't ever make a decision in a conflict situation. I just work with the group. So what I do, and I've learned this, that if I am patient enough, and if I am willing to wait and not put a lot of input into the group, that somewhere in the group the word of wisdom is going to come from somebody. I learned that very early on in this work, and I'm thankful for having learned that lesson. So I'm writing, and the list is getting longer, and it's getting close to 10 o'clock. And at the beginning, we agreed that the meeting will not last any longer than 10 o'clock. And that's very important. Congregations get very worried about meetings that last till 2 in the morning with everybody fighting. So you say, you agree at the beginning, what time shall we end? And we agree, 10 o'clock. So sometimes it's 9:30. I remember one of my first meetings with a group, somebody said, in this congregation, God goes home at 9:30. If you want to stay, you can, but the rest of us all go home. So I'm waiting to see where is the word of wisdom going to come. And usually it comes close to the deadline. So it's getting close to 10 o'clock, and I'm waiting. And finally, this list is there. And when you put it down, it all looks kind of, you know, you think. So over to my right was a man who hadn't said a thing all evening, not a word. But I can almost begin to judge now where in the group the Spirit is working, because I see the person become a little restless and, you know, just a little agitation. And I look for it. And then I see that person and I kind of acknowledge and maybe smile a little bit. So they feel like it's okay to get up. And this man gets up, and obviously not a theologian, you know, and not anybody who's there with a Bible pounding it, because that doesn't do much good. And he gets up and he says, I've been sitting here thinking about us. Whatever happened to forgiveness? He said, whatever happened to forgiveness? Sure, the pastor made an ass of himself. In fact, he made a double ass of himself. But which one of us hasn't made an ass of ourselves? You know, there was quiet in the group. And then somebody over here said, maybe we need to ask the pastor to forgive us. And that was the end of the meeting. We closed very quickly on that. And I said, I would like to meet with the leadership afterwards to talk about organizing a pastor-parish relations committee. We end with a task. They're going to do something afterwards, not going to just leave it there. And we say, from now on, then that group will deal with such matters. But the upshot of it was, no real decision was made, but the word of reconciliation had come into the group. Now, that's 2.5 years ago, and the pastor is still there. And he admits he has grown a lot. And the congregation has the committee that works, and they admit they've grown a lot in their understanding of how to deal with conflict. So the word of wisdom comes, and comes from the group in which the Spirit dwells. Now, I think it's very important. That's my think with, as John Schramm would call it. My think with is that in the body of Christ, while there is all, there are also, that while there are the seeds of conflict and dissension, there is also the Holy Spirit, who is the reconciler. And I, for me, if you were to ask me what is the goal of conflict management, the first goal that I would have would be reconciliation. Reconciliation, rather than decision-making and all that sort of thing, or conflict resolution. There's no such thing as conflict resolution. There's just the management of conflict. Therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. The old has passed away. Behold, the new has come. All this is from God, who through Christ reconciled us to himself and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. That is, God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself, not counting their trespasses against them, and entrusting to us the message of reconciliation. So we are ambassadors for Christ, God making his appeal through us. And this morning in John Schramm's study, talked about blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. So I'm going to put these up. I brought this along rather than spend time writing them down on the board. If you want to write them down, it's very important in any conflict that the leadership take things into their hands and provide structure. That doesn't mean solve the problem. And too often the leadership thinks they have to be the problem solvers. But you have to let people know, how is this thing going to be dealt with? Now, too often, I don't know what the problem-solving method in your congregation is, or how your leadership acts to make decisions. But sometimes I think this whole business is just you pretend the conflict isn't there. And that, of course, is denial. You just act like nothing happens. If there is an incipient conflict, it gets shoved under the table and nobody deals with it. But that only is like a pressure cooker. You push it down, and eventually it blows up. And then it'll blow up in ways that you couldn't even imagine. Some little thing happens, and all of a sudden you've got a big conflict because nobody was dealing with the small issues as they came up. Okay, you publish. Who is invited to what meetings? You know, is everybody invited? Is the congregation invited to this meeting, or is just the church council and the committees? Say, who is invited? Because nothing's worse than to think that you're going to have a closed meeting and have everybody show up and then have to push them out. So you say, on Wednesday night we're having a meeting, and only the... But then you say, we will have an open congregational meeting next week, Wednesday, or whenever it is. So you let who is invited to what meetings. And then, as I said, you say when the meetings begin and when they end. And if you say they're going to end at 9:30 or 10, you be sure they end if you're right in the middle of it. And just say, we'll take this up again and have a time to recess until. So provide structure. Publish what the agenda will be at each meeting. How many meetings have you gone to and you didn't know that the agenda was going to be that? You thought it was something else, and you got there and you found that the pastor was the agenda, or the church council president, or the youth director was the agenda, and you didn't know that. So publish what the agenda is, and then only take additional items on the agenda if the whole group agrees that should be dealt with that evening. But publish the agenda. Okay. What all the steps in the resolution process will be. Well, will it take a month? Will it take 6 months before you decide that whether or not a steeple ought to be built or not to replace the one that fell down? When each person or group will be heard. I said 1 minute for each. And nobody speaks a second time till everybody speaks a first time. And when will the ALCW's concerns be heard? At what meeting can they come and lobby for their point of view? When will the youth, when will the choir's concerns be heard? And everybody gets a chance. Who will make what decisions? Who's going to decide? eventually, after all the facts are gathered, is the council going to make the decisions, the executive committee, the worship committee? Who makes the decisions? And who has the right to vote? I put that in orange, but you can't see it very well. I think nothing is more potentially disastrous than to have a congregational meeting, and then suddenly when you get up to speak, somebody says, you're not a voting member. You ever had that happen? You know, even when you go to the polls to vote in an election, they have a list published of who can vote in that election, who's registered to vote. So if you are going to exclude some people from voting whose names are on your membership list because they haven't communed or contributed or attended for whatever your constitution says, publish that list beforehand. Say, according to our constitution, which says, and then publish that article, these are the voting members of the congregation. You don't have to say who isn't. But you publish, and then if anybody says, how come I'm not on there? They have a chance to do that beforehand. How will any decision-making be conducted? I think that, and the rules of fair and open discussion. So those are some of the things we've been talking about. I'm going to give you a chance now to do a little thinking. Here, if you want to pass these around, everybody can take one. And let's see, maybe I'll need one too. Yes, I think there are enough. In fact, there'll probably be a little extra, a few extra. Be sure they get in the back. Now, this is a case study in a pretty common type of conflict. Those of you who heard Dr. Bowman last week, you remember he said that you can preach heresy from the pulpit and get by with it probably more easily than you can changing the liturgy. Well, I think one of the worst things that can happen to a congregation is to change the hours of service. So I've called this worship in the clock, and I'll read it so that the tape can hear it. Pastor Mentor presented his new Sunday morning schedule to the congregation at its annual meeting. Instead of having services at 9:30 and 11 a.m. with Sunday school held at the same time as both services, we're going to have the first service at 8:30, Sunday school at 9:45, and the second service will stay at 11 o'clock. That way, children can worship with their parents, and we can also build up our adult education program. At present, adults just do not attend our Sunday morning classes. Nobody said much at the annual meeting, and the worship committee agreed with the pastor. But the next day, telephones were ringing throughout the congregation, and an intense reaction against the plan was started among first service regulars. Why should we have to change, they asked each other. We don't want to have the kids in church. Nobody will get anything out of the service, and anyway, they don't want to have to listen to a sermon they can't understand. Gradually, plans developed for a boycott of the new 8:30 service. We'll get together at home and worship until the worship committee realizes we mean business. The people who came regularly to the 11 o'clock service termed the reaction childish and wondered why all the fuss. Most of them were older and didn't have children in Sunday school, and they thought they might even enjoy some of the new Bible classes. The pastor has a hard time understanding the intensity of the opposition to what he considered a reasonable plan, and one that could only enhance the worship and teaching program of the church. But the telephone calls kept coming. His wife was verbally attacked at her mother's circle meeting, and some of the Sunday school teachers quit because of the fighting going on around them. Okay, you want to talk to the person next to you about that for a minute? And you tell me how you'd handle the conflict. Now, who has the solution? Who's going to go in and resolve this whole conflict? He's going to go to Sunday school, not to church. Okay. Okay.
Well, I'm going to decide that if whoever makes the decision, that I'll abide by what they.
First, I want to
know what the problem is.
Okay. What's the problem? What is the problem?
Why change?
Change without consent.
Well, I started out wrong in the beginning.
How did it start out wrong?
Well, it's a classic example of a group think meeting where the leader comes in and tells you what they're going to do.
Okay.
He came in, the pastor came in and said, this is what we're going to do.
Okay.
He didn't really allow much for discussion.
It's very important to, you know, to understand how decisions are made. And you have a hierarchical model, which maybe used to work more in churches than it does now. The pastor makes a decision, it goes down to the next level, and goes down to the next level, which, and each place represents less decision-making power. And then down here, you know, people just get the orders. That works very rarely now. There still are places where that does work, though, and you'll have congregations in conflict because the next pastor won't work that way.
Yeah.
You know, congregations adopt certain styles, operating styles, and I think often it's the organizing pastor who imprints a congregation with a certain leadership style. It's very difficult to change, and pastors, you know, well, they have different, this is very simplistic, but you have pastors who are task-oriented and pastors who are people-oriented. And sometimes they're more 75% and 25% people. Or you could have a pastor who's 25% task and 75% people. And if you make too drastic a switch, you know, get a people-oriented pastor or task-oriented pastor at the opposite end of the continuum, and the one follows the other, very difficult for congregations to switch leadership style. And so we first of all analyze how are decisions made. So that was a hierarchical model. Another model might be voting, which we think is democratic, but and I suppose which most of us do. You vote on an issue and you decide. But the problem with that is you tally up the votes, and here are six over here and five over here, and you say this is the way we're going to go, but you got half of the congregation that is not happy. So voting is not always the best.
That's what we did at my church.
You voted on an issue?
We voted on it. Everybody had input. We voted on it, and then we decided on one thing. Some people were happy, some people were unhappy, but
yeah.
Those that were too unhappy left.
Yes.
The rest of us stayed, and we're comparatively happy.
Yeah, but nobody really wins because you lost part of the community. And if reconciliation is your goal, you know, that you want to keep the community together, and you have the idea that conflict is a way to grow. Conflict is a way for our community to become stronger. Because we talked about in that in personal fighting, interpersonal fighting, it's a way for a relationship to grow stronger because you say, hey, we survived it and we're still together. It shows how much we care about each other. So, you know, if you hadn't lost those people, you would have had a better feeling even among the ones who are left. Okay? So another way is negotiation. Negotiating. Which is the way we use in society, in labor management disputes. You know, you have a professional person come in and you just make trade-offs. You say, well, we'll do this at the first service if you do this at the 11 o'clock service. And that's what negotiation does. It says we trade off. Sometimes that's good. Works very well often in marriage counseling. Like if a very common complaint is the wife will say, you know, my husband comes home at night and he doesn't want to talk, and here I've got all this stuff that I want to talk about, and all he wants to do is take a can of beer and sit in front of the television, and I've got all the things to say. And then the husband will say, yeah, well, the problem is, you know, I come home tired. And this is a very kind of traditional home. Now they both come home tired. And they both maybe have a lot to say. But he said, all I want is peace and quiet. I just want to sit alone and relax. So you work out the contract. You know, he will have, or she will if she's out working, have half an hour to be alone. Nobody bothers them, and they understand that's the contract. But then, later on, you have a time set aside. So you do trade-offs like that, negotiating. Okay, another way is, and this probably
would be the best method, collaboration. If the pastor had found out the thinking of all the people, of all the committees, if he had worked through the worship committee, given them the idea, let them do the surveying and the discussing with people and listening to input and getting ideas, you know, somebody may have come up with a better solution. You know, maybe they would have decided to have Saturday school if Sunday school was the issue, and then having children come to the worship service at the same time if they wanted to. Well, whatever, a collaborative model says that everybody is taken into the decision-making process. But you have to have a congregation that's willing to go through that, because it takes a lot of time. You have to be willing not to make immediate decisions and to allow for a process. Somebody has described my job in a way I like. Pastor Dave Lundy in Goleta, California, when I was working with him and his congregation on a Hispanic ministry, he said, I know what your job is all about now. I said, what is it? And he said, you go around the district hanging out horse blankets. Well, not having grown up in Chicago and not being from the farm, he had explained that to me. And he said that when he stayed with his grandfather on a farm in Wisconsin, grandfather told him, you never put a new blanket on a horse, because if they do, they'll shy and buck it off. But he said, you hang the blanket up in the stall for a while till it takes on the smell of the stall and the horse gets used to it. And then when you put it on, the horse accepts it. So he says, that's what you do. You go around hanging out horse blankets, you know, planting a seed. And I think that's true, because, you know, you can put an idea and say, is this something that needs to be done? And immediately people shy back. Oh, no, you know. And then lo and behold, it comes up in the council like it's somebody's own idea. Like they never heard it. Say, I got this great idea. And you hear your idea coming back in new terms. So another way of decision making, and we've talked about this, is avoiding. You're just avoiding issues that need to be dealt with, and nothing happens. And nothing is more frustrating to a congregation than to have leadership, whether it's the pastor or the council, that never makes a decision on anything. I have seen more conflict generated by do-nothing leadership. And, you know, just, what do you call those? Well, anyway, there's a management term. It calls them 1-1 leaders. You know, if on a grid you had leadership that on a 9-point scale, you had leadership that was concerned for people or for task, as we said. And then you have 9 here, 9 here. Well, a 1-9 leader would be somebody who is low on task but high on people. And if you had a 9-1 leader, that would be somebody high on task but low concern for people's feelings. Just get the job done, you know. But if you have a 1-1, you know, they don't care about people or task. They just sit, you know. And it drives groups nuts to have that kind of a leader. Then, of course, the ideal is always the 9-9. A great concern for both. But most church people are 5-5. You know, they're compromisers. They'll go along with both. And then if none of these work, if you can't put any of these into practice successfully, and you just don't ever make decisions. I'm not saying any of them are bad, because they all work in certain groups. Some groups can determine by voting, and the group will hang together. Some negotiate everything out. I like the collaboration model, but it does take time, and sometimes you have to make decisions very fast. Then you might say, it's okay, let the pastor say what we're going to do, and we'll go along with it, you know, as you mentioned. But, and then the last way is to call in a consultant. Now that You have to be pretty thick-skinned to be a consultant in conflict, because you're usually called in when the crisis is at its worst. And everybody is shouting mad. Some people have already left. Attendance has gone down. Giving has gone down. And you're often called in too late. I would recommend calling in a third party early on. As soon as you see that the sides are not talking to each other, that no one person has the trust of both sides. But the problem often is that the pastors feel they can take care of it, or that the church council thinks they can handle the situation. And it doesn't work. Are there any questions?
Would you explain to me again the difference between negotiating and collaboration? I'm not sure I've got that clear.
Yeah, negotiating usually says that you have one person there, or like if it's a conflict between pastor and congregation on, let's say, housing. You know, do you get a housing allowance, or do you have to live in the parsonage? Can you buy your own house? It might be then that the church president or the council will act as the arbitrator of the thing. Or you get somebody else to come and negotiate between the council and the pastor, if the council is the decision-making body in this. Or you have a housing committee. And you simply make trade-offs. Maybe you'll say, well, we don't want to sell the parsonage, but we'll put aside equity payments. You know, it will accumulate. And then you make certain rules, like you have the pastor, if he stays here this long, he'll get this percentage, this much. If he stays this long, he gets... You know, maybe you have a restricted fund of $25,000 and you negotiate out. So it's kind of trade-offs. Maybe the pastor would rather have his or her own home, but the congregation can't. So you work out a mutually satisfactory situation. Usually there are pretty clear-cut trade-offs to be made. And it's no use bringing in a consultant on that, unless you want to bring in an outside arbitrator. That's a pretty common
situation. I understand negotiating, but I don't see the difference between negotiation and collaboration.
Right.
Is it a function?
Collaboration, yes. Collaboration is an ongoing kind of process. It's a way you operate. You have a structure set up that says whenever a decision is made, it must first go to the committee concerned with that area of church's life. And that committee decides on the process for making the decision. And then the committee brings its conclusion to the council. And then the council discusses it and maybe trusts the committee enough to take their decision and to act on it. And the pastor comes in an advisory capacity.
So it's a matter of how hot the issue is then.
Yeah, or it's an ongoing way. It's the way you handle all decisions. Like we had a decision made in our church by a little group that they're going to hang microphones over the choir to pick up the sound more evenly. That became kind of a bone of contention. Somebody gave the gift that bought the microphones, but the worship committee said, why weren't we consulted? Because anything that happens in the sanctuary and that affects the worship is supposed to come through the worship committee. So that became a point to say, how are decisions made generally in the congregation? Okay?
How do you get a consultant?
Oh, well, usually in every district, there is somebody identified on the district staff who is the conflict management person.
This is ALC?
Yeah.
I'm absolutely astounded to hear that. Coming out of a conflict, which the church would not help at all.
Really?
I'm sitting here,
well,
absolutely astounded.
It differs in different districts, but we have a very clear cut.
Your
in a way.
Is very fortunate.
I usually handle all conflicts in the congregation side.
It's tremendous. I think it's a tremendous idea. And I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you might ask about that, you know.
Oh,
and
ask.
Who will help?
Yes.
Yeah. That's too bad.
Should a pastor be permitted to sit in on a meeting at which his salary is discussed?
I think that depends on the congregation. Some congregations can work that out very well. You know, they'll talk to the pastor about his or her needs and how it's working and discuss what the income is of the congregation. And some are very arbitrary about that, and it's only discussed in closed sessions. So I think it depends on the style. If you have an open kind of a collaborative style in your congregation where nobody minds discussing potentially, dangerous topics, why, it could work very well to have the pastor in there. But
if they ask him to leave and he doesn't,
what do you do? If they ask him to leave and he doesn't,
yeah. I voluntarily always leave.
Yeah, and some do, yes.
I was going to ask you, how do you get a pastor to leave when you would like him to leave? And there's no way, and we've written letters to the synod and to their bishop and everything, and there's no way.
Yeah.
He's there for, as far as we can see, forever.
Can you leave the church?
No, leave our congregation.
He's
been there for 13 years, and we would like to change. We would like a new personality.
This is one of the most difficult of all. We have a lot written in the rubrics of the church about the call process, but very little about how do you fire somebody, which is what it comes down to,
that's
you
right.
know.
We can't.
It's very, very difficult. We don't have any procedures.
Are calls more?
Some congregations are going to renewal of calls, and we're trying to work out a process for ongoing evaluations, asking the congregation and the pastor to sit down together and evaluate what's happening. And so to kind of free the pastor to say, well, I'm getting a little bit frustrated with this congregation. And the congregation say, well, you know, we feel a little frustrated with the leadership. We feel nothing's happening. And then if you can dialogue about that. But you have to have people in leadership who are not threatened by honesty and openness.
Oh, our pastor's terrible.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that ought to be a function then of the bishop of the district because the bishop of the district really works with pastoral assignments and calls. And I think our bishop is very open to this kind of movement. And sometimes it's very difficult. And bishops are human beings too, and sometimes their friends are the ones who are threatened, you know. And then sometimes they'll ask somebody else to go in and work with that congregation. So that is the bishop's prerogative to work with those kinds.
He's ignored.
Yeah. Well,
what do you do?
It's frustrating, really.
But the bishop only ignores it so long, doesn't he?
As far as I know, he's ignored it now.
Yeah. Well, that's why you need.
How long is too long?
That's why you need some form of conflict management, because that's a potentially hazardous situation. It's explosive, and it can tear a congregation apart. So, yes, we do need some method in a district for working on that.
Marge, in a case like she's talking about, if each member of the congregation wrote to the bishop, wouldn't that make a difference?
Sometimes it does.
If he tends to have confrontation.
Yeah. And it depends on what the issue is. Now, I feel that it's very important for us to have programs of continuing education. We're trying to work out some way that will be required for all pastors to take courses of study, like in management, in creative programming, and whatever it is, that we don't consider that a pastor's training is finished when he or she finishes seminary. You know, doctors now in California have to, go through their boards tests every 5 years, and they're talking about doing this for lawyers, or maybe lawyers are already doing it. But why shouldn't everybody? My daughter is in charge of continuing education for 1,200 engineers at Northrop Aircraft, and she works in cooperation with USC and UCLA to provide management courses and all the things that they need to grow in their job.
And
so
they're sending her off to get her master's.
Yeah, she'll get her MBA paid by Northrop to increase her skills. So yes, I think there are lots of things that need to be done. I see movements toward that, but it takes time.
Do you see movements in the LCA?
Oh, the LCA is much. They tell us they're much better organized than we are. So
not in my synod.
Yeah.
Our pastor happens to be a chaplain in the Army Reserve, and we as a congregation can feel
the added stimulation that he gets from just being gone, his 2 weeks or whatever, his reserve, and
yes.
the new material for his sermon that he even brings in from just not being in the same mode
yes.
all the time, just being a pastor.
Right. Well, you see, we have staff people in the American Lutheran Church have continuing education opportunities. I was sent back to Lyle Schaller's executives training course on congregational life, and he's a church planner. I've been to several things that I'm expected to go to have my skills upgraded. So why not the leaders of our congregations, pastors? And it is coming, and the continuing education centers are taking that more seriously. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Happy conference.